Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week Ian's back, who was living in his car, maybe still is, giving us a progress report. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Ian, who was living in his car. He spoke to us a couple of weeks ago. Ian, how's things going? And just maybe for people that didn't hear last time, how did you end up sleeping in your car?
I ended up homeless because the property I was living in was sold under the wishes of my late parents' will. The money was split between me, my brother and my sister, who both live in foreign countries. So I'm the one who stayed at home and looked after Mum until she died, and now I'm living in my car.
So it's not as if you haven't got some money to pay rent or put a deposit down. You probably got plenty if you've got a third share from the house, but how come you can't get somewhere to live?
It's like I said to you last time, it's private landlords who want references, won't take DSS. As soon as I say I'm out of work, they don't care about my private money. All they care about is, oh, it's the unemployment thing again.
Very irritating. I don't know, is there any help from the Bristol City Council or South Gloucestershire Council at all?
Well, yeah, since our last chat, I had a couple of phone calls from councillors, both from Bristol and South Gloucestershire councils.
Fantastic. Well, look, this is it, folks. If you know anyone who's in a sticky, dicey situation, who the authorities are failing, get them to come in on Dialect and hopefully we can get things moving. But so what's happened, Ian? Actually, is it just words or has anything actually changed?
It is words, but the manager of South Gloucestershire Home Choice has looked into my situation and he seems to think that there might be a property coming up soon. So it's just a case of doing what I've been doing for the last 7 months, you know, going on South Gloucestershire Home Choice, looking in the papers, looking on online for flats and apartments that are empty, and just hoping that eventually I'll get somewhere to live. But
well, it's not bad, is it, that you've got the actual manager of South Gloucestershire, which is where your last accommodation was. I mean, this is the one of the, you know, as you become homeless, you start to realise how the system works, don't you? And one of the things you've figured out is that you've got to apply for your housing in the previous place to where you actually were being housed before, when you actually were being housed. So you can't apply, for example, in Bristol to be housed when your previous accommodation was in South Gloucestershire. Have I got that right?
Yeah. Yeah, but you can, even though I was living in South Gloucestershire, I still could have been on Bristol Home Choice. So it was a case of South Gloucestershire or Bristol, and I chose South Gloucestershire. So, you know, since my last interview, things are progressing slowly, but it's not a quick fix to my homeless situation. It will get done sooner or later.
What about things like squatting? Have you thought about that? Because, you know, when you find yourself homeless, all those things that you thought you'd never have to do, you have to start thinking about, don't you? Did you think about squatting?
No, because I'm lucky that I've got a car that I can sleep in. But if I was without the car, then yes, squatting or buying a tent or something like that would be considered. But yeah, you know, but I'm lucky in a way that I have got a car that I can sleep in. So, you know, that is better than nothing, to be honest.
Well, and also, you have got a small community of people, don't you? Actually, probably a growing community of people who are in a similar situation.
Have they been
helpful?
No, I where I park up at the night time, I've got a bunch of friends and we all look after it. You know, they're professional lorry drivers, so they night out in places in Bristol. So really, in a way, I live in my car, and Monday to Friday, they live in their trucks. But they go home to a family and a house every weekend, whereas Monday to Friday, they lived in a truck. But, you know, we have a laugh and a joke, you know, and if anything happens, then I'm sure one of them would be there to sort out any problems. You know, where I park up is quiet. We don't have, you know, we don't have any trouble with the yobbos, so...
But you do have some trouble with the police, don't you?
Oh, yes.
Would you like to tell us about that? Because that's just over the last few days, isn't it?
Yes, last Friday morning at approximately 5 past midnight, two police officers came to my car. They done a PNC check, which is who owns the car, where's it registered, this, that and the other. Then one of them decided he wanted to wake me up.
So hang on a minute. First of all, they do a PNC check. Don't they have to have a reason to do that? Or can they just harass anybody that they don't like the look of?
If a car is moving, they have to. If they want to stop you, they have to stop you within 3/4 of a mile. Not many motorists know this because it's a law that they like to keep to themselves. But because it's a stationary car parked up in a side street on a weeknight, they seem to think it's a God-given right that they can. Apparently I was told that my car's had 27 PNC checks since...
Well, it's funny you say this, Ian. You won't know this, but we had a chap in here, Maurice Kirk, over the last year or so. In fact, he was taking South Wales police to court. He was going through a proper process right through the courts because he was suing them for harassment, having stopped him over the period of several weeks, 2 or 3 times a day to do... PNC checks. So this is clearly something that the police are using to harass people. I mean, be honest, had you done anything to warrant this?
No. They say they're checking on my well-being. Once a month, fine. 2 or 3 times a week, that's bordering on harassment. I'll give you another case of police harassment that I've suffered over the years. Because of my interests, I go to a meeting in Pershore in Worcestershire twice a month. Every time you come out the pub, you walk from the pub to the car, you get in the car, you drive a mile, straight away, breath test.
Well, that's good, isn't it? That's exactly what the police should be doing.
Yeah, but I've been drinking Coca-Cola or orange or soft drinks all night, so...
Maybe they should put that on your database to do with your car. This guy only drinks Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us what sort of meeting is that you're going
It's a group of aviation enthusiasts. We get together once a month. We talk about what we've seen, where we've been, what's coming up, like... With the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, a lot of people went to the air show at Duxford. Like the 777 that caught fire in Las Vegas, we talked about that. You know, general aviation chit-chat that we have once a month.
Well, that sounds great. I'm sure some people might be interested in coming along to that. We do have a few aviation... Maurice Kirk, not the least of which, is one of their aviation enthusiasts that comes on.
Yes. I'll give you another example of... some kind of police harassment. During the mid-80s, we were up in Lincolnshire on a chasing a NATO exercise around Lincolnshire.
Hang on. Chasing a NATO exercise. So you're driving, chasing what? Aircraft?
Yeah.
Tanks?
We go from base to base. Like, there's 3 bases within a 35-mile... And basically, you'll have, like, the French turn up at one base... The Germans turn up at another base, the Dutch, the Norwegians, the French, they'll turn up at another base. So what you do is you just go from base A, base B, and on to base C, and then you just repeat the same thing for the 3 days of the exercise.
And what are you doing, taking pictures?
Taking pictures and regis of the aircraft.
Yeah, you see, the thing is they're going to start thinking, well, hang on, who is this guy working for?
Nah, it was car park. It was parking tickets. They claimed we were on double yellow lines. My car was 25 metres from the nearest double yellow line. When we got the first ticket, we thought, oh, okay then. Went off to another airbase, got another parking ticket. Hang on a minute. This is now...
Well, you can see what's happening behind the scenes. Probably NATO and the military are saying, can you do something to the civil police to hassle these people? Because they don't
The military police actually love us.
But so who was it was telling them to give you some hassle?
The civil police do it off their own backs.
Yeah.
When we went back to base A in the late afternoon, the same copper that gave us the first ticket was there issuing us. So we took photographs, went to court, and we won. Basically, we proved to the magistrates that we were not on parked on double yellow lines. And so we got costs, you know, day's pay, fuel from Bristol to Lincolnshire, and it all came out of the public purse.
Great. Well, I mean, it's exactly fine. That's actually a good way to spend public money. If the police are actually harassing people, then they deserve to pay for it. So well done for taking him to court, Ian. This hobby of yours, is it have its advantages and disadvantages when it comes to being homeless?
Yeah, great. I can wake up, I can get information off various e-groups, Facebook, Twitter accounts that I belong to, and I can wake up one morning in Portsmouth with a 110,000-ton United States Navy aircraft carrier. I just look out my window, and there's this great big boat.
You know what? I really admire you for turning this rather awful situation of being homeless into something a bit more positive, Ian.
Because,
You know, the worst thing that can happen is that you start sinking into being just totally depressed, as we were talking about last time. And I think it's fantastic that you've managed to find something to do, which is you could probably only do if you had a car.
Well, that is why, you know, people think that I'm stupid for doing what I do. But it's like 3 weeks ago, I got some information. I just drove from here to Newmarket in Suffolk, spent the night in the car, got up Saturday morning, photographed some really exotic aircraft that were redeploying from Germany back to America. Even yesterday, last night, I was travelling up the M4 M11 to Suffolk again. This morning I woke up in Suffolk. So, you know, yes, it has its advantages, you know, in a way. I'm lucky because I don't have to. I've got a landlord chasing me for rent and this, that, and the other. So all the money these landlords are not getting, I'm using to pursue my hobbies. And believe you me, I'm having a whale of a time. So
well, that's
yes.
good. That's good to hear. You know, because there's a lot of people out there who are homeless who ain't managing to turn it into something positive. I mean, for example, I mean, you're saying Suffolk. This is Mildenhall, Lakenheath territory, isn't it? This is a lot of these big, long runway, massive American bases. I mean, when you're taking photographs, what kind of aircraft are you? You say exotic aircraft. What are you seeing up there?
2 weeks ago, I saw the first deployment of F-22 Raptors, which is the U.S. Air Force Advanced Tactical Fighter.
Is this like a stealth fighter type thing?
Yeah. Today I was photographing Air National Guard deployment from which was in Romania, defending NATO against the current onslaught of abuse from Mr. Putin. So, you know, Mr. Putin.
So hang on, are you talking about the National Guard? So this is a US National Guard jets sitting in East Anglia, basically, and then zipping off to Eastern Europe?
No, they were in. They flew from their bases in America to Romania. They've been on deployment in Romania. Unfortunately, some of them suffered technical malfunctions, and they
decided they would stop off in East Anglia to get the guys to get the spanners out.
Yeah. It's at the moment there's a current deployment in Estonia of Air National Guard A-10s, which is one aircraft the Russians hate the most.
Why is that?
It kills tanks.
Ah, right, yes.
It's a tank buster. Believe you me, it's the most feared weapon in the NATO armoury.
So, I mean, the thing is, aviation and no-fly zones, this is becoming one of the main front lines, isn't it? I mean, for example, we had in Libya, and it's interesting to think you've managed to sort of turn a hobby, aviation hobby, into actually getting to understand this. So what other experiences have you had of... Because I can remember, I mean, I'm just thinking back a few years now to the whole rendition program, where although a lot of people point the finger at plane spotters and say, oh, they're nerds, actually, that was a very important part of exposing part of that illegal program of flying people around the world to illegal sites. I think, am I right?
Yep. Yeah. And also, another thing that not many people are aware of is we've all heard of Area 51 in the books and on magazines and on TV programs.
Is that Nevada Desert in America?
Yes.
Yeah?
But they is an airline that operate unmarked airliners, and they fly from Las Vegas to Area 51 three or four times a day, every day, 7 days a week. To the normal general public like you just think, oh, it's a 737 taking off. To us who know the aircraft, know the colour schemes of the aircraft, we know where they're going, which is Area 51.
So you say it's an unmarked aircraft, so that's an aircraft without any kind of, like, it's not an airliner, it's not got an airline's logo on the side?
It is a white 737 with, like, an orange, a blue, a green, yellow stripe on it, and that's all the markings it's got.
Right, so it's almost like this is almost a stealth commercial airliner, isn't it? Because most people wouldn't notice there's anything wrong with it. What's on that plane? Why is it going there?
It's taking the workers out to Area 51.
And what? We'll give you a couple of minutes to give your theories here. What is Area 51 really all about, Ian?
Testing of secret aircraft that the US government do not want the general public to know about.
But surely, I mean, we see these. You just talked about the Raptors. We do see these. I mean, you can't hide them, can you?
Yeah. We're talking about the U-2 spy plane, the SR-71 Blackbird, the F-117 Nighthawk were all developed under top secret. In fact, the SR-71 program was actually above top secret. From the initial Oxcar program onto Senior Crown program, which was the SR-71, it was all done at Area 51, / Groom Lake.
So, but those were all a long time ago, weren't they?
In the 1960s, and they're still going on today.
So any thoughts about what they might be developing now that we don't know about? I mean, we've seen these stealth jets and things like that.
Let's talk of a Mark VI ramjet called the Aurora, which is the SR-71.
Oh, yes. I've heard of
final
this.
Replacement, but...
Yes, I know it's a journalist called Nick Outerside, who, when he was working up, I think it was the Aberdeen Press and Journal, did a really interesting article about the Aurora, saying that it was landing up in Scotland at Macrahanish in the middle of the night. No.
The only person to land in, the only really interesting thing ever to happen in Scottish airspace was Elvis Presley, who got off a plane going back to America, got on another plane, and then flew back to the States.
So nothing interesting ever happens in Scotland?
No.
Well, you see, I mean, how would you know? You see, because Macrahanish is airfield. I mean, it's on the Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah.
And the runway actually goes right out into... It's all barbed wire everywhere else. But the runway goes right out to the sea. So something at the middle of the night can land at Macrahanish, which is a great long runway, from the so long as it's flying from west to east, and no one would be any the wiser. You won't see a thing. All you'll hear is a bit of a roar in the distance.
There was a rumour going around years ago that Boscombe Down in Wiltshire, there was a secret American stealth jet had a crash in Boscombe Down in Wiltshire. It's never proved.
Well, you won't prove it, will you? Because it's all barbed wire everywhere.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you... So you managed to get through the barbed wire in a way with your telephoto lens, do you?
Yep. Most of the aircraft we photograph are actually up in the air. So most airfields have a security policy of you can photograph the aeroplanes, but don't photograph the buildings.
I mean, surely a lot of what you get, though, is rumour, isn't it? That you just, I mean, literally, you don't know whether it's true or not, Ian.
Not nowadays. In the old days, yes.
Well, how do you verify it? How do you back stuff up?
Facebook, Twitter.
Hang on. I mean, anybody can write something on Facebook and Twitter, surely.
And post photographs.
Oh, right, okay.
Hence, when I went up to Milnall the other week for the F-22 Raptors, I didn't leave Bristol until A, I had the full regs of the aircraft, and B, I was lucky enough to see photographs of them landing in Milnall.
Oh, okay, so you knew where you were going.
I knew
up
they
there.
Were there before I left Bristol.
You're not wasting any petrol money, are you?
No.
So do you know why these planes had to land? What was wrong with them?
Yeah, their tanker broke down.
Oh, right, so they couldn't be refuelled.
No.
So it wasn't actually the jets themselves.
The rumour is that one of the jets snapped the boom off the tanker.
Oh, dear. Naughty, naughty. That could be quite an expensive mistake.
Yeah.
Especially if they're actually being used in wartime and were needed.
Yeah. If you see the front, there was two A-10s came over to the UK for air shows earlier in July. If you look at the nose of one of them, it was so battered where the refueling boom had hit the fuselage. It looked like, a dirty old banger that parks on the street. So, yeah, but, you know, it's a case of, you know, air refueling is a dangerous process. The American Air Force do one system. The US Navy do another system. We do a similar system to the United States Navy.
But so which is the best system for refueling?
Easy ways, it's the American Air Force system, because you are flying an aircraft onto a fixed boom, whereas the Royal Air Force and the US Navy use a basket. So what you're doing is you're flying a probe into a basket. Now, during an event in 1982, where two Vulcans went to the Falklands to bomb the runway, it took 19 tankers to get it there and back. And believe you me, they were half a tonne of aviation fuel short of their last refuelling. So they went from their last refuelling point all the way down to the Falklands and back, and they were half a tonne of aviation fuel short.
So how come they didn't fall out of the sky?
That is for the grace of God. Only God himself knows why that mission did not fail.
Amazing. I mean, don't you sort of just get labelled as a conspiracy theorist?
No.
No?
No. We're classed as anoraks, saddos.
I mean, what about the, you know, the big conspiracies, things like Diana? Have you got theories about that?
I have.
Yeah? Go on.
Yes.
Let's hear them. I mean, because the thing is, in the aviation world, if you're corroborating what you're saying and you're talking to people in the know, you're likely to be knowledgeable, where most people will be in the dark.
There is a theory that Diana was killed accidentally by a government agency.
I don't think it would be an accident, Ian, would it?
It was. She was collateral damage. The person she was after was Dodie Fayed. The reason being is his father is the biggest contributor of money to the PLO. Now, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to work out what country would like to see that form of money stop.
Well, I mean, is there any evidence that the Israelis were even involved?
Yes. Two Hercules left Paris Charles de Gaulle 20 minutes after the crash.
Right, crikey. So, you know, any evidence for that?
Yeah, there were several plane spotters that I know got the Hercules Saturday. Come Sunday morning, they wasn't there.
Okay, so this is people actually on the ground in Paris taking photos of Israeli Hercules on the ground.
Yep.
Next day, they're gone.
Yep.
Wow.
But that is a conspiracy theory. You see, the trouble with Al-Fayed is he is convinced that Diana was the target. And his son was collateral damage because of the alleged baby that she was carrying. And there's also another conspiracy theory saying that he wasn't the father of this alleged baby.
Well, certainly. One thing's for sure is that Dinah was definitely annoying the royal family in all sorts of ways. And there was a definite... I mean, people I've spoken to over the years, including someone who was in the know about this, said our lot did it, basically. They were involved.
I don't agree with that. You just got to have a look at the secret services of certain
countries. So you think it's a foreign secret service that did it?
Yeah. Why would the British Secret Service want to kill Diana?
Well, there's a lot of theories about it. One is that the landmines...
The Queen is just a civil servant, like most civil servants. The Queen has not got the authority she used to have. So she's just a figurehead of the civil service.
That's fascinating, that the idea of these the disappearing... Israeli Hercules aircraft.
It's more of a disappearing car than the Hercs.
Which disappearing car?
The white car that's never been found.
Oh, the photographer's Fiat Uno.
Whatever.
Fiat Uno it was, yeah. So that's disappeared. Any other ideas of, sort of bigger news stories like the Diana killing that you've, through your plane spotting, you've sussed things out?
No, that's the main one at the moment. The funniest joke at the moment is the MV-22 Osprey, which is the aeroplane that thinks it's a helicopter.
Right, what is this, American?
It's British? An American. Yeah. The Japanese have just brought some. The joke is they're safe for the US Marines, US Air Force to use, but the President of the United States is not allowed to fly in one because the aircraft is unsafe.
Oh, Ian, amazing chatting to you again. Well, look, you were woken up in the middle of the night by the police doing a check on your vehicle, which is really irritating. If they do anything like that again, please do, come in and let us know. But also, give us an update, maybe in a month or so, and let us know how you're getting on with the housing. Because I'm so fed up with hearing nice words from councillors and council officials, but they don't actually come up with the goods. So let's hope they do with you, Ian.
Yeah.
Okay, Ian. Well, we started talking about your encounter with the police Friday, early hours of Friday morning. Was it Saturday morning?
Yeah, Friday morning.
Can you tell us what happened?
Certainly.
They woke you up.
They tried to wake me up. They flashed their little torch in my face, and I just hid under the duvet after failed attempts to wake me up that way. One started banging on my car window, and then the other one decided to kick me repeatedly.
Kick you or the car?
Kick me. Kick my feet. Now, being diabetic...
Hang on. So what, were your feet hanging out the car?
Yeah. Basically, I'm claustrophobic, and the car is small. So on a dry night, I open the door, and I let my feet out. And the police decided to kick my feet 10 times, resulting in I have got very sore feet. I can barely, as you saw when I hobbled in, I can barely walk from here to the toilet and back. I find anything, I can't do anything at the moment. All because this PC wanted to wake me up.
Now, hang on, because you actually have got a condition with your foot or your feet, haven't you? What's going on?
I've got an injury called the term is policeman's heel. It is a sports injury that people who do a lot of jogging, running, sports will suffer in their life. There's two ways you can recover from it. One is you do daily exercises for up to 12 months, or you go into the doctors or the hospital and you have a cortisone injection. The trouble is, also being diabetic, people lose toes, feet, legs to diabetes. So not only has he kicked my feet with his footwear, he's also possibly damaged certain senses in my foot.
So your feet feel different, do they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, did you actually make complaints to the police about this?
I made a complaint to the stationed in Patchway. A inspector phoned me Friday afternoon and said, I'll pass all your details on to his duty inspector, who was supposed to phone me Tuesday. And it's now, and he still hasn't phoned me.
So that's actually an assault, isn't it? I mean, this is the amazing thing.
If the police saw me and you kicking somebody, yes, they'd arrest us. Charges, we'd be in court, fine, possibly jail sentence.
So do you manage to get the badge number, collar number?
Because I'm short-sighted and it was dark. Also, South Gloucestershire Council are starting to turn the streetlights off for 5 to 6 hours every night. So not wearing my glasses, being dark, I was unable to see his face, his collar number. But it does leave a bad taste of sour grapes with the police, because going back to my aviation hobby, a lot of police forces are trying to get spotters to keep an eye out for security reasons at airports. They do what they call an airport watch scheme. But for some unknown reason, Avon and Somerset just seem to have this habit of antagonising people the wrong way.
Well, Ian, I'm really sorry to hear that. I hope the police compensate you for damaging your feet.
They've got to talk to me before they compensate me. Yeah. And at the moment, they just don't want to talk to me. So, you know, sorry if you find this hard to believe, but it did happen. I'm sat here in the studio with two sore feet. I can barely walk. And
I don't think most of us who pay our council tax pay it to these police to go around kicking people who effectively have got, you know, injuries already that are nearly making them disabled. So that's not what we pay the police to do.
But what do we pay the police to do? I'd like to know, because you've got a chief constable. I presume Nick Garman is still in place after being told by...
No, he's suspended.
I thought he has been told by...
Well, a judge has said he should get his job back, but he still hasn't got it back because the Police and Crime Commissioner has said no.
Well, she should sack him.
She can't sack him because he's not done anything wrong. Or he's not done enough wrong to sack somebody.
The trouble is, because of his situation, other officers are probably thinking, oh, well, he's got away with doing something wrong, we'll do the same thing.
Well, he hasn't actually got away with it, but anyway.
You say time and time again.
I mean, what you've got is you haven't got any clear leadership from the police. So I suppose that's another reason why police officers might think,
There's no direction in the whole... police forces. You know, this isn't just Avon and Somerset. This is every police force in the country. It's like I said to you jokingly last time, we should do away with the police and get drones in.
Anyway, Ian, I hope it doesn't come to that, but let us know how your complaint with the police goes on.
Okay.
Thanks very much for coming in and sharing that with us again.
Okay. Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Hello, I'm joined by John Long. Hi, John.
Hi.
I'm always a little bit mystified as to how quite to introduce you, but I know you're involved in supporting addiction communities in the city. Tell us what you're up to.
Sure. Well, there's all sorts of initiatives and activities going on in Bristol. For many years, Bristol's been quite a sort of thriving centre for the recovery community in the UK. It might have something to do with the enormous number of rehabs in the West Country. A lot of people go to rehab, and there's an awful lot of them in Somerset and in the West Country generally.
Why is that? Do you think we have a lot of people, a lot of addicts around here? I remember seeing a few years ago, actually, someone, I think it was Clive Smith, the filmmaker from St Paul's, doing a kind of vox pop with addicts in St Paul's who were chasing the heroin around and saying, oh, well, actually, Bristol's the cheapest place in the country.
Yeah, yeah. It's a port, you know, and I think that's got a lot to do with it historically.
So is it coming through Avonmouth, the airport?
It's getting here somehow.
The other thing is, isn't it also a place where, I mean, one of the traditional things, that particularly in the States they started doing this, was the authorities, whoever they may be, whatever authority they might have, actually deliberately make sure that drugs are sold in places where they think there might be kind of civil unrest or very well organised communities. So maybe it's a compliment that the drugs are so free here in Bristol.
Well,
I'm
quite good friends with a guy called Mark Gilman, who used to be the main advocate for recovery in the Department of Health in the UK. And he was on a fact-finding tour of the USA, and he had an amazing conversation with the chief of police in New Orleans. And New Orleans at the time was the murder capital of America, with very high murder rate, a huge influx of crack cocaine. And he was saying to the chief of police, what should we do about this? He said, well, what we need in New Orleans is a big increase in the amount of brown heroin on the streets. And that was his solution to the fact that New Orleans was the murder capital of America.
And
I mean,
did it
he was
happen?
Joking.
Did
know.
It happen?
I don't know.
But, so how? Okay. So explain that. How does that help with if it's a murder capital?
I think it's it's just the natural antidote to a stimulant is a sedative, and there's no finer sedative.
It almost sounds to me as if some of the international drug peddlers are sort of almost doing these kind of mass consciousness controlling, like trying to change the way a whole city thinks by which drugs are for sale.
Well, it's quite extraordinary how you see these changes in fashion, if you like. It looks like a change in fashion, which is driven by the demand side, but actually it's as much driven by the supply side as well. And you see huge increases in people taking legal highs and big increase in the number of people who are, this dramatic increase in the number of people who are smoking weed. And, this stuff on the streets now called AK-47, a madness, and it's got incredibly high levels of THC and low levels of CBD, and it's causes psychotic breaks, but it's about replicating the effects of other drugs with weed. And it's become industrialised, it's become almost weaponised weed.
Is that, God, that sounds awful. Is this genetically modified, or are there chemicals added to it, or what?
It's modified, it's dipped, it's dosed, and all sorts of things going on with weed at the moment, and various different rival gangs are obviously in a competitive turf war in terms of trying to produce stuff that's stronger and stronger and replicating the effects of other drugs with weed, like crack and heroin. So
I mean,
it's
it
getting stronger.
Simple as going back to Key Largo, the film with I think it's Humphrey Bogart, isn't it? There's a marvellous scene in that where you've got these prohibition booze peddlers who are absolutely mortified at the idea that that it might be legalised, that alcohol might be re-legalised.
Sure,
and
is
it quite like that, do you think?
I think it is. I think there's some concern about the fact that the legalisation, especially around weed, the legalisation of the medical uses of weed has been a significant threat to
people
who are currently involved in distribution.
Put your hat on if you can for a minute. I'm not saying you do have such a hat, but if you were an international drug dealer, why would you be so worried about your commodity being legalised? Surely you could start to sell it legally.
Well, that was you would think so, wouldn't you? But there are all sorts of drivers in terms of not wanting that to happen, because it's just in the nature of illegal distribution that it's a different mechanism with different market forces that are in play.
Well, one thing occurs to me straight away is, if it's legalised, then it could be taxed.
Yes, of course, absolutely. And so that would be an atom, wouldn't it? So, and of course it would be regulated. And then big corporate entities get involved and they're ruthless in their own right in terms of the way in which they operate, but in quite different ways, of course. So,
Looking at the bigger picture again, before we start zooming down a little bit into recovery and what you're up to, again, the government, didn't they, I think it was the end of last year, announced, maybe beginning of this year, announced that they were going to be including drug dealers and drug dealing in the national GDP figures and the figures that they present to the IMF and to the world about how economically productive Britain is now including. How on earth do they do that?
Well, I suppose there's it's some sort of ludicrous recognition of the fact that a very large proportion of Britain's middle classes are now taking drugs on quite a large scale. They have to balance the books somehow, don't they?
And so, why do people take drugs, John?
Well, that's a great question. Why have they ever taken drugs? I mean, that's a marvellous question. I think for so many people, it starts fairly, innocuously.
Well, it starts with things like coffee, doesn't it?
It starts with things like coffee.
Tea, even.
Well, now look at my own history. I suppose my first my first addictive substance was probably my compulsive relationship with sugar when I was about 6 or 7 years old, you know. And then watching my dad, my mum wasn't a very good cook, so I used to watch my dad, you know, sort of really gorging on cheese at the end of a meal, you know.
And but cheese isn't a drug, surely?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my dad seemed to have a pretty compulsive relationship with it, you know. But sugar certainly is, you know. And so, you know, these are... I mean, sugar is clearly... We now know so much more about sugar as it's effectively an addictive neurotoxin, you know. And it's a mind-altering substance, you know. It's one of the most addictive of the lot, so... and, you know, the obesity epidemic is testament to that.
Yeah, nicotine is incredibly...
And nicotine's another one, you know. And nicotine's a very interesting drug in the sense that it's a stimulant when you want it to be and it's a sedative when you want it to be as well, which is why it's so addictive and so Moorish. So there's no shortage of addictive substances and there's no shortage of addictive behaviours, you know. So, we've now got 1 million women in this country who are addicted to online gambling, you know, as a result of the recent deregulation. So,
okay, so yeah. Where is the crossover between something which is chemically addictive and something which is habitually, like you were talking about the gambling?
Sure.
Are there similarities?
I think there are tremendous similarities, yeah. I think, you know, if you look at the level of compulsivity around internet addiction, around porn addiction, around all the behavioural addictions, there's a lot of evidence now to support the view that they're every bit as addictive as and destructive as behaviours as addiction to mind-altering substances. So, you know, anything you do absolutely compulsively and obsessively and increasingly has the potential to spiral out of control. And,
well, if there's anything in your life that is you feel might be an addiction of some sort, try giving it up to see if it really is an addiction or not.
Exactly, yeah? Exactly. That's a very good marker for whether or not you've got a problem with it. There are two key markers, really. You know, can you reliably control how much you're doing it? And if you've decided to stop doing it, can you stay stopped? And if you can't do both of those things, there's a pretty good chance you've got a problem. You know, so at a simplistic level, those are two very good markers.
But there's quite a long spectrum, isn't there, between sugar and heroin?
Sure, sure. There is you could say that, but if you've got a compulsive relationship with sugar and that has spiraled out of control and it's a chronic and ongoing problem that's resulting in, you know, metabolic disease and a whole range of other health problems, it's a serious issue. And it could be, and a very destructive one. So, you know, it's interesting to look at addiction from that perspective.
I mean,
in terms of what's socially acceptable and what isn't.
With Piggate, you know, one of the things that's come out about that is that this Piers Gaveston Society, there was a lot of drug taking going on. There were people like Nat Rothschild. I mean, certainly anecdotally, when I was living in Oxford, they were saying, well, the Rothschilds are addicted to heroin, but they can afford it.
Mm, sure.
And so you would probably never notice. They might just have one shot every morning or one every evening. Sure. Does that sort of thing happen amongst the upper classes?
Absolutely, of course. I'm sure it does. And I'm sure that's a common problem in other parts of the world. You know, if you look at the pattern of addiction, the profile of addiction, I mean, there's a massive problem with unrecognised heroin addiction in parts of the world where heroin is much more normalised and socially acceptable, but it isn't really recognised in the same kind of way.
Well, it seems to be quite socially acceptable at certain drinking clubs or dining clubs at Oxford.
And, yes.
You know, is it feasible that someone like George Osborne, for example, could be a heroin addict and people wouldn't know?
Well, I couldn't speak for George, but I'm certainly aware that, you know, that addiction is, as a condition, cuts right the way across the social spectrum. You know, there's this assumption that we tend to have this fairly, you know, cliched view of what an addict looks like. You know, it's someone on the streets, it's someone who's addicted to heroin, you know. But there are all sorts of manifestations of addiction. You could argue that hoarding billions of pounds in secrecy locations, hoarding is an addiction, you know. It's an addictive
behaviour. Well, actually, that could kill the planet and kill society, that kind of addiction.
Absolutely.
So maybe it needs to be addressed. So what does the... I mean, if you're painting this fascinating picture of a sort of Cliftonite addict,
yes,
who's managing to hold down a job, got plenty of money, wife, kids and everything, mm-hmm, and then maybe a St. Paul's addict who can't.
Sure.
So is that, does it really go right between the two?
Yeah, completely. I think it does. And I think there's a lot of new evidence that Public Health England, I think, are going to produce some new data on trends of addiction in the UK. And there's been a big increase just quite recently in compulsive and addictive drinking amongst middle-class women in this country who are, you know, swilling Chardonnay on an industrial scale. You know?
Why is that then?
I think it's a lot to do with social pressure. It's a lot to do with stress. It's a lot to do with a lack of security in the workplace. There's a whole raft of reasons why addiction is taking on pandemic proportions around the world and manifesting in different ways. Certainly in India and China, you're seeing a big increase in addiction to benzos and benzodiazepines and over-the-counter pharmaceuticals. And that's been a huge increase in addiction in those sorts of areas, which is tragic and having devastating consequences, which are starting to be much more clearly understood.
Well, except if you're a shareholder in a big pharmaceutical company.
Of course, exactly right. You know, and you know, but if you go to Asda and have a good look round and think about what's addictive and what isn't, you know, what proportion of the stuff they're selling is addictive? I mean, it's a huge proportion of the stuff that's sold in a typical supermarket has addictive attributes.
Whereabouts in the city would you say, John, are good places to go for expertise on recovery, drug addiction, this kind of thing? Because, I mean, not all of the statutory projects will be the best place to go, will they? They never are. So where's your place of choice, do you think?
Well,
where does the real expertise lie in the city?
Well, I think the fascinating thing about recovery is that there is a thriving recovery community in Bristol. Recovery is something that's happening in the community. And it's happening in the places you would expect it to happen. You know, it's happening in mutual aid groups and mutual aid organisations where people are helping one another. It's happening in areas where people have experience of staying abstinent or, you know, of addressing an issue and maintaining their recovery over a period of time. But I think what's really fascinating about it is that you don't hear much about the recovery community and what it's doing in the press. But it's a thriving community, you know, probably consists of a couple of thousand people in Bristol who are actively identified themselves as being in recovery from something. It could be gambling, it could be heroin addiction or crack cocaine addiction, it could be alcoholism.
I mean, is there a proper spread of people from, you would expect, from the rich to the poor?
Yeah, absolutely, there is. I mean, I'll give you an example of a group that I'm aware of. You know, there are something like 95 Alcoholics Anonymous meetings a week in Bristol, spread all over the city, in every part of the city. And they're meeting in places you would expect them to meet. They're meeting in community centres. But, you know, there are something like 18 Narcotics Anonymous meetings a week in Bristol, around the city. There are 8 or 9 Cocaine Anonymous meetings a week. There's a Marijuana Anonymous meeting that meets in Bristol. There's Gambling Addicts Anonymous. There's Gamblers Anonymous. There's Overeaters Anonymous. There's lots of support groups there of just people who are supporting one another to deal with and to maintain recovery from an addiction to a substance.
And where's a good gateway into these groups if people are interested?
Well, check out the internet. Look at 12-step recovery. There are also SMART meetings, and SMART's an interesting organisation that's been set up to provide a secular or scientific approach to recovery, and there are plenty of SMART meetings in Bristol, well established now. Bristol's the pilot city for the rollout of SMART meetings, and it's a different approach to recovery and to mutual aid. But the fascinating thing about it is that it's all about mutual aid. It's about sharing experience and people helping one another to address an issue. And I think that's the same internationally. You know, you come across these fascinating organisations which are happening in the community. And recovery is quite contagious. You catch it from being around people who've done it. But from my own experience, you know, I know that, you know, I had no idea there was a recovery community in Bristol. And I've been in dire need of it for 20 years, you know. And I kind of discovered it as a result of looking online at where there might be meetings and discovering that this community existed in my hometown. But it's just in the nature of the condition that there's a lot of stigma attached to addiction and to compulsive behaviours. And so, quite understandably, the recovery community has been quite low-key in terms of, for many reasons, if you're a doctor or a judge or an airline pilot, and you've got a problem with addiction,
or a member of Her Majesty's government, or a member of the royal family.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Got to keep it. We never know who you're going to bump into one of these Bristol meetings, do you? Well, anyway, look, John Long, thanks ever so much for chatting with us again, and I'm sure you'll come back soon and let us know. You know, just keeping us up to date with this side of the city, I think, is fascinating and really useful.
Yeah,
thanks,
great.
John.
Thanks, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined by Angela Balassi now. Angela, you've got a story about the National Health Service this week.
Yes. Apparently only one NHS call in four is answered. This is the 111 number.
Only one in four. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like calling it now and just seeing if we get answered. That is rather dangerous, isn't it? Because people could be desperately in need of that service.
It's not the emergency number, but it's the NHS 111 service.
The trouble is, sometimes people will phone 999 and then they get told, actually, no, you have to phone 111. So it's not very good if they then phone 111 and get no reply.
Well, yeah, apparently 75% of calls are going unanswered in some areas. And it's been reported that a single nurse has been left to cover an area containing 2.3 million people at one centre. And this is according to a whistleblower who spoke to the Daily Mail.
Wow. And this is the Western Daily Press you're reading this out of. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually quite like the Western Daily Press. I know it sounds like a terrible thing to say, but they're much better, I think, than the Bristol Post. And they include a much broader range of stories. I mean, these sorts of issues, it seems incredible to me we can be living in a country where something so important as the National Health Service and one of their main helplines is not working and there isn't a bigger fuss about it.
Well, that's very true. And also the Royal College of Nursing has warned that the non-emergency number will be completely overwhelmed. And as you're saying, if people go to that first before calling an emergency number or maybe are given misinformation, then it can be a serious problem.
It's going to put a massive extra strain on the emergency service, which might then mean that people with actual emergencies might not be able to get through. Don't you see this, folks? Come on, sort it out. I wonder also what you think of the general use of this sort of technology, call centre technology, whether it's actually been a real advance in technology or not.
That's difficult to say. I mean, I think regardless of technology, you still need people. And according to this report, some patients have been forced to wait 11 hours for a nurse to give them a call. And also staff who have been manning the phones have been sent a series of emails begging them to do overtime or even cancel their holiday.
Now, it does sound to me like a combination of mismanagement and just lack of money. Is that right?
I mean, I don't know, but it certainly sounds as if they've agreed that there is not enough staff. So even if you have proper management, if you haven't got the people to take the calls, you know, to do the labour, then no amount of management would help, I would have thought.
And also, there is this general problem, of course, in the idea that this is bypassing doctors. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's a bit like the things like the work capability assessments that are being done as part of the DSS or DWP, Ian Duncan Smith's department, is that you really want doctors to be making these diagnoses, not nurses or people who aren't trained up to that level.
Well, the Health Minister, Ben Gummer, has said that it's a vital service helping people to get medical advice and support, and they have 7 million calls in the first 6 months of this year alone. So it's his first port of call, I'd imagine, and then maybe doctors or emergency services would be the next step.
So that's about 1 million calls a month, so that's about 3/4 of those going unanswered.
It is. It said they've already, you know, failed to meet their targets in the first half of the year.
And I wonder what the consequences will be for those companies that are doing that service. Does it mention that at all in the article?
It doesn't.
Oh, dear. Well, I think I've got a suggestion here. Maybe they should just lose their contracts and get another company in, or maybe even the National Health Service can do this kind of thing in-house. Do you think that's feasible?
Again, it depends on numbers. So they're already at the point where they're asking, I believe it's staff, and I believe they said it was nurses that were left answering these phones. And if they don't have enough nurses or staff, then I think the answer is to recruit more people.
Yeah, well, that's a basic one, isn't it? Do you think there's any other things to learn from this experience?
It's a vital service and it should be made more of a priority.
Well, it should be a number one priority, shouldn't it, I think? Anyway, Angela Balassi, dipping into the Western Daily Press, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. Broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Ian, homeless chap in his car still, John Long also talking about recovery, and Angela Balassi. looking at the Western Daily Press and the NHS 111 service, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now. And we leave you with some music from Wiltshire's finest, Bob Naylor.
As I was walking down Birmingham Street, in me fine scarlet coat and everything neat, enough to entice all the maidens that day, when they set their eyes on you, ramble away, oh ramble away, oh ramble away. When they set their eyes on you, ramble away. The very first steps I took into the fair, I saw pretty Nancy a-combing her hair. I gave her the wink and she rolled her black eyes. Thinks I to myself, I'll be there by and by. There by and by, oh, there by and by. Thinks I to myself, I'll be there by and by. As I was a-walking that night in the dark, I took my bright Nancy to be my sweetheart. She smiled in my face and these words she did say, are you the young man they call Ramble Away? Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. Are you the young man they call Ramble Away? I said, pretty Nancy, don't smile in my face, for I don't intend to stay long in this place. Well, I gave her three doubles and fair length and share, and I told her I'd ramble the devil knows where. Oh, devil knows where, oh, devil knows where. I told her I'd ramble the devil knows where. Well, when 24 weeks they were over and past, this fair pretty maid, she did sicken at last. Well, her gown would not meet, nor her apron string stay, and it was all through the love of young Ramble Away. Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. It was all through the love of young Ramble Away. So come all you fair maids, where'er you may be, with courting young fellas, don't make yourselves free. For if you should do so, you'll rue the sad day when you met with the likes of young Ramble Away. Oh, ramble away, oh, ramble away. When you met with the likes of young Ramble Away.